All right, good evening, everyone. This is Andrei Stepanovic. I'm moderating the Greek Plays Reading Discussion Group for Reading Odyssey. It is February the 7th, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And we will be discussing the introduction to the Greek Plays, edited by Mary Lefkowitz and James Rom. We're going to also kick off this call with a discussion tonight of The Persians by Aeschylus. And after about 45 minutes or so, Phil Terry will be on the call with us introducing Professor James Rom, our special guest scholar tonight, who, of course, is one of the editors and one of the translators of this edition, and he will be able to answer more specific questions than I can. So, but in the meantime, I'd like to go over some ground rules real quickly with y'all, and then look at the book itself to point out some of the key places in it that we can refer to for during our discussions, and then we'll be discussing the play. So, first thing, in calls like these, some of you have already been on these calls with Reading Odyssey, and some of you may not have, but basically just a couple of things to keep in mind. It's hard to see anyone raise their hand, so if you have a comment, just tell us your name. Your first name is fine. And say something like, "This is Andre. I'd like to ask whatever it is you'd like to ask, or I'd like to comment and say whatever." And I'll try to moderate that best I can so that we can hear each other and be able to respond to each other. I'll try to keep track of any questions that you have so that if we don't get to them right away, we'll get to them when the discussion kind of turns a corner and gets back to that, or save it for Professor Rom as appropriate. Okay? Let's see. I think that's it. Are there any other questions or anything else that you'd like me to address before we get into the
Andre, I'll just, since we're both on the line tonight, I'll offer myself as an assistant moderator to you.
Yeah, please.
So,
do.
If any of you are wanting to make a comment and having trouble getting a word in, just shoot me an email, pterry@gmail.com, and I will help get you in on the conversation. And I just wanted to say to all of you, welcome to the 2017 Reading Odyssey and to the Greek Plays program. We're very excited to be doing these plays and to have the support of James Rom, Professor James Rom, who we'll hear from later this evening. We also have several other scholars that will join us. Sarah Rudin, who translated the Oresteia for this edition, will be joining us on the next call. And then Professor Paul Cartledge from Cambridge University will join us on the last call that we'll do in July. I'll also just give you all a heads up. We're very excited. I'm waiting for confirmation on dates, but we expect that the landmark Caesar will be published later this year, and Reading Odyssey is planning a major program of lectures, of course, reading groups and discussion groups like this, and some in-person events. So you'll hear more about that later this year, but just wanted to give you a heads up. With that, Andre, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Phil. Thanks very much for giving me that little breather. I wanted to bring up a couple of things that are worth pointing out with the edition, regardless of how much or how little you've been able to read in this book so far. We want to set the stage, so to speak, tonight with some of the background very briefly. A lot of it is there for us to peruse and absorb at our own pace, but in order to get at these tragedies, especially this one, the Persians, I just wanted to point out a couple of key things. So in our textbook, we have a great set of helps here. Looking at page Roman numeral 7, we have a bit of a timeline, and it's entitled Lifespans of the Three Leading Greek Tragedians. You may want to keep a bookmark or dog ear or something on that page. We don't have to know all these details, but it's just good to see how we're going to be moving through these writers and in the context. So tonight I wanted to look at this page, especially with regards to Aeschylus and how he, how his play, The Persians, is one of the first that we have in our hands, one of the first ones or the earliest ones, and the setting of it is right after the first Persian War, and actually after the second Persian War as well. So that's the setting of the play, but it's also the setting of the production of the play. And as we go through more of these plays, that setting is going to let's say reverberate off of whatever the themes are. So more about that in a minute. If we turn the page, we've got these great maps. The first one of Athens and the surrounding area of Attica, and this is actually where the Persians, or let's say the play, is talking about the battle around Salamis or Salamis on this page. And you can see Athens, and to the left, slightly below, to the left is the island of Salamis. And that is where the whole battle that defeats the Persians takes place. So I wanted to point that out. The facing page is a wider view of Greece and the Aegean Sea. And so this is the approach the Persians took to attack the Greeks, not only at Thermopylae, but also at Athens. Okay, and then finally, the next page is the Black Sea and the Persian Empire, and that will take us to the actual setting of the play in Susa. It's to the far right, lower right. You'll see that's one of the major cities in Persia, and that's where news is going to be brought about the defeat. So we can see this great gulf, a great distance between the Greeks and the heart of Persia there. Okay? Any questions about the geography? It's just a very brief overview of that. The other page that's facing that is a great view of the theater in which the play was been performed. We have two versions, an early reconstruction of the Theater of Dionysus. That's where all of these plays in this book were performed at one time or another. And the early version of the theater is at the top, and it's embedded into the hillside as it looks today, by the way. The lower version is a built-up, more ritzy version, which, still using the same location, but with a few more helpful buildings and such. The roundness of the stage area, which is called the orchestra, is the early version of the Greek pre-tragedy kind of plays called the dithyrambs. They were circular dances that the Greeks would watch and perform in as part of rituals and religious rituals to Dionysus. When the tragedies were performed in this same space, they started to change over to a more rectangular and linear kind of dance structure. But the Greeks kept their circular performance area. And that's about all I know about that particular part of the performance. All right? I wanted to move into the general introduction and just point out a few brief things about the text and the translation, and take a couple questions on that, and then we can start talking about the Persians. So Any questions so far, or any comments, or do we have any experts on tragedy in our group tonight? Okay.
Personal tragedy, yeah. You mean Greek tragedy? Okay.
Yeah. Anybody on? Okay. So, yeah. Sorry about that. Hopefully, nobody is an expert on tragedy in general, just the Greek tragedy. So, a couple of things I really liked was the opening of the preface here talks about Robert Kennedy's mention. We cite from Agamemnon, which we're going to be reading next month. But the really interesting thing about the translations are that they're very, very, you know, very close to the actual delineation. In other words, they follow the Greek by line by line. So that's a really difficult thing to follow, and Professor Rahm might be able to tell us more about how that worked for the translators. But also, the whole tragedy is basically a song. So there are different rhythms and meters and, you know, and patterns in it, and regardless of how much or how little you want to try to follow that, these translations do point out at times when the rhythm will change and so forth. But just remember one thing, that it is really a performance, and it's a musical performance in addition to what we think of as just a typical play. The interactions between gods and mortals, I'm looking at Roman numeral page 21. This is a really important part of most of the tragedies. The Persians is sort of an exception, except for the ghost of Darius. He's kind of a supernatural presence. But in most of the other ones, it's a very interesting mix, or where mortals are, you know, meet immortals, so to speak. And that's a real staple for these tragedies. I'm going to leave it at that. And as I want to respond to what you all have questions on in terms of the form of the plays and so on. So we'll leave that for our discussion in a moment. The beginning, or the introduction to Aeschylus' plays, we find out that he is mentioned by Aristophanes, and he has a reputation. I think he was a very, very old man when he died, and there's some funny anecdotes about him. But he lived to a great old age, and he is the oldest of the three tragedians that we know of and that we have work from. And then on page 5, just regular number 5, in our introduction to the Persians, we covered the setting and the actual historical background for the sake of our play, is that Xerxes has decided to reinvade Greece after the Persians had been beaten back at Marathon, and this time he's going all out, and he is going to not only double or triple, but I think quadruple or quintuple even the number of troops that he wants to march into Greece. He's going to overwhelm the Greeks, but it's almost ironic that the amount of people he has in this invasion is almost what undermines it. So on page 6, the themes that pop up in plays like Persians can be keywords like cables or yoke, and how those words can be used to imply or bring up different meanings for a specific mention. Cables could be a great way for instance, the Persians to cross the Bosporus on their bridge across from Asia to Europe, but in the same way it can be almost used in a sense to be fetters or tie them up. So you can look for these things in the plays and anything else that pops up in the reading of them. So all right. I'd like to get to the actual play itself. And that starts on page 11 and starts, of course, with the chorus. And I wanted to just open it up now to you all. How does the chorus feel to you, and what is the chorus? What is the function of it, or what is, the purpose of the chorus in this play, opening the play, opening up this first part of the play. So we can read the first couple lines or first few lines to get an idea of how the play begins here with the chorus. Let's take a look at it. I'll read the first sentence or so of it, and that'll be lines 1 to 7, I think. The chorus starts with, "Here are we, the trusted ones of the Persians, gone to the land of Greece." So these are the trusted ones. These are the ones that are not only onlookers as usual chorus, but they are some trusted servants of King Xerxes who've stayed behind while almost everybody else, it seems, has gone to Greece. "We," in line 3, "the guards of the wealthy, gold-decked places, chosen as fits our age and rank by Xerxes himself, our lord and king, the son of Darius, to steward this land." So here we have automatically a statement of separation, of distance. And it is quite a distance, as we saw on the map. And they're waiting for news to come back. And so there's a little bit of anticipation here. And it starts with the next line, with the word "but." And here is where we get our beginning of our tragedy. So let's hear from some of y'all about either this opening or anything else in the play that we could kind of get a foothold in or anchor ourselves on. We'll just go from there.
This is Scott.
Yes.
If y'all can, just for me, this, after he talks about his worry and then they talk about the army going forward, and then there's this just magnificent roll call of names. And I think for anybody who's read the Iliad, you think of the catalog of ships, that where he rolls through the whole Greek army, and it's remarkable to me that and this is a pretty obvious point, but it's amazing that he's doing this about the enemy army.
Yeah,
like some play about World War II began with some big speech about all the German regiments or something like that, or the ships in the Japanese fleet.
Great. Yeah. Excellent. Good. Thanks, Scott.
But he was Greek, so I took it as, because even in the end, and when they're talking about all the people, the Persians who died, I took, this is Nan, by the way, sorry.
Yes.
But I took it as this is for a Greek audience. So it's kind of like tooting their own horn in a way.
Yeah, sure. It could be, right? And it could also be a very familiar format, right, to draw in the audience. Sure. Sure. Great observations.
Hi. This is Pat. Hi.
Hi, Pat.
Hi. Well, I think, I think it is, like when they start talking about, when the messenger describes how the Greeks overcame the Persians, I think it would have been very patriotic. It would have stirred up your patriotic blood of the Greeks. But, at the end, I don't think it's gloating, like, oh, now we're going to get to see the Persians and really enjoy their being beaten down. I think it's kind of sympathetic, kind of.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amazing that I mean, it was, if the Greeks had lost, they would have been really trounced on by the Persians, you know. And yeah. So it's really amazing that this was such a sympathetic play. I don't think he's so sympathetic that he wants the Greeks to lose, but, you know. I was sort of amazed. The opening chorus, I mean, I would have expected them, I mean, this was a big surprise. It was a big upset. And but the chorus is like, even the very beginning chorus, they're already afraid something has gone wrong, even before the messenger comes. And I'm sort of, that's sort of strange to me.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's a mixture of emotions here. And I think this is really interesting how it does start from the Greek point of view to sound very, look at all these armies they sent at us, right? From the Persian point of view, is it a way that they're kind of, you know, trying to build their own confidence up here in the midst of this dread, you know, that they're feeling, right? Who knows? It's and then how that moves to the end, right? To something different, to something more sympathetic. And so I think it's a great point. I think it's a really good point. So how do we get from one to the other? Yeah.
Yeah, let me just jump in. It's Bill. So I just want to ask Pat a question. Pat, you make a really good point about how you really were surprised to see that the play is not, as you said, gloating about the victory over the Persians, and that there's some sympathy, in fact, for Xerxes and the Persians. Can you just say a little bit more about that, and do you talk a little bit about how many years has it passed between the battles of Salamis and Plataea and the production of this play? Do you remember that from the introduction?
Well, are you talking to me or the moderator?
Yeah, I'm speaking to you. Yeah.
Oh, to me? About how many years? Well, there was not that. There has been, I'm trying to remember what it was. I did say in the in the beginning, but it's like not that many. I mean, he was still...
Short, right? Yeah.
He was still... the author, Aeschylus, was... he'd fought in that, in the battles. So it's you know, it's pretty close. It's like, you know, in the 1950s, talking about World War II or something, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And it makes it even more impressive, right? So maybe later when we have the conversation with Professor Rom, we can explore this a little bit more with him, why he thinks the Persians, why Aeschylus took a sympathetic view, and what that teaches us about the Greeks and this moment in Athenian history. But I appreciated your comment, and I wanted to just remind us all of, you know, how fresh in memory of the audience and the playwright were these events that take place here.
Good point. I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yes.
This is Pat again. I have a question.
Sure.
It seems like the Persians are praying to the Greek gods. I always assumed that the Persians had their own gods, like Mazda or Baal or somebody, but they're talking about Zeus and Ati and all the Greek gods. Is that historically accurate, or what? I don't understand that.
Yeah. Let's see. Can you point us to a specific line? That might help a little bit.
I'd have to keep going through it.
Comment.
Try a line about 532 where the chorus says, "Zeus, our king, you have destroyed the proud and teeming army of the Persians."
Yes, and in my translation, this is Elizabeth, I didn't order the book in time, so I don't have the same book you're all reading, and I'm reading the Loeb edition.
Okay.
And the Persians refer to themselves as barbarians. Is that the word that's used in the Greek? I mean, I don't think the Persians would really refer to themselves that way.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know what I mean.
Yes. There is definitely going to be a pro-Greek point of view, exactly. Now, the,
In the footnotes on that, there's a footnote that says that, you know, the word for barbarian from the Greeks just meant anybody that wasn't a Greek. I mean, it doesn't right. have a connotation like we think of barbarians, you know, people that are just bloodthirsty and uncivilized and stuff.
Right, but so if you wouldn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, but you wouldn't refer to yourself that way, would you?
No, let me read that footnote. It's footnote 27. And Professor Rahm says in that footnote, at several points Aeschylus has the Persians refer to themselves as barbaroi, or as here, to their land as barbari, illogically adopting a Greek perspective according to which they were foreigners. To translate these terms as barbarian would be misleading, as the word clearly would not have a pejorative sense when applied by the Persians to themselves, which is why he went in a different direction. Although I think this is another great thing we can footnote and get to later in the call and ask him his perspective. But
right.
it's helpful. Thank you for bringing that up, Elizabeth. And I know, Andre, I want to pass the baton back to you. There were a couple of people I think trying to jump in.
Okay.
Hey, Andre,
Sorry.
Yeah,
this is Kitty, and just referring back to the first commenter, this play, which I've never seen performed and read for the first time, really, really reminded me of the Iliad in a million ways, and,
mm-hmm.
and everything from, you know, the way the action starts in the war is by Xerxes overreaching when bad companions taunt him into trying to best his father, and he takes it a bridge too far, so to speak, and the same with, you know, the same in the Iliad when Agamemnon is taunted into taking away the going too far from the bounds of decency and taking away the prize of Briseis from Achilles, and then the fact that the war was won by trickery, which the Greeks, you know, loved to use, but viewed as somewhat ignoble. There's that famous embassy scene in the Iliad when Odysseus and Phoenix and Ajax Telamon go to try to bribe Achilles into coming back. And he knows Odysseus is lying, and he says, I hate that man like the gates of Hades, who says one thing but holds another in his heart. And yet it is Odysseus who wins that war, and as it is trickery that wins the Battle of Salamis. And again, there's that issue of, you know, the it begins with a sort of catalog of ships, and it ends during it. There's a distinguishing of each of the Persians who falls in battle. They describe one as a master of horses, and another one as an insatiable spearman. But most of all, it reminds me of the Iliad because of this, what I think of as the most characteristic Greek quality of being able to see things from others' points of view, to view something in which you might have a tremendous personal stake from a point of view in which you're not at the center, and to treat your adversaries as equals. And so the emotions that this play left me with is pity for the Persians, just as the Iliad and leaving you weeping for Hector, who's a Trojan. And if you didn't know that Homer was a Greek, you would just as easily suspect that he was a Trojan from the way he covers those two sides. So I've gone on for too long, but I really could not get over how much this seemed like the Iliad to me.
That's an excellent point. Thank you. And it makes me think of two things. One, there is a dream in here, right? And there's a dream in book two of the Iliad, Agamemnon, and it's a dream that leads to trouble. But there's also the whole wrath. I mean, the first word of the Iliad is wrath, and Xerxes is known for his wrath. I mean, that's what fueled this whole adventure, right? And then it led to this tragedy. So,
and then Agamemnon blames his wrath on Ate from the gods, and the chorus describes Xerxes' wrath as Ate at some point in this play. So it's they're very weird, interesting parallels.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I like it. Okay.
Hey, Andre, this is Alan.
Yes, Alan.
Andre, this. Yeah, I had a, going back to one of your original comments, the chorus, I think, sets, for me, I think this is a warning by Aeschylus, who is a veteran of these wars, not to overstate or to gloat in your victory, because the gods in fate have funny ways of coming back. And so to me, this is a warning And secondly, it's not to overdo it, because it's only 6 years after Plataea when he writes this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on line 93, the chorus sets it out when he says, when they say, what mortal man can dodge the trick-filled deception of God,
mm-hmm.
who thus has mastered the easy leap with a nimble foot? And then it goes on to the famous, kindly and wheedling at first comes reckless Eightday. But then she leads men into nets and snares, so no mortal man can jump over our hope to escape. Mm-hmm. And to me, if I think of the second lease as a veteran who fought in both Marathon and Salamis, sat on the benches, he knows that war is a haphazard event at best.
Yes.
To me, this is a warning that he's sending out to, I think, to the Athenians, not to overstate your victory.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Sean. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Sean. Hey, yeah.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I'm desperately trying to find a location on the Kindle here. But later there was that, like, the speech about when everything's going well, everybody thinks it's always going to go well, and when it doesn't, everybody thinks it'll suck forever. And
yeah.
So I felt the same
way.
Great
quote.
This was like it was a little more
line
than 600? That. But,
is that line 600, Scott?
Yeah, I think it's, if it's a
Tosa
speech, I'm thinking of it's like
590. That's
the line
number. Yeah, I'm lost right now, but I felt like the whole itemizing of everybody who came at us, right, and they beat us, they had so much power, and so obvious they're going to beat us, and then also the empathy for the Persians. It all feels to me like it's a setup. Like, let's not get carried away with our awesomeness here. So that we don't have the same, we don't go off and try and kick somebody else's ass and lose all our kids too.
Yeah.
And this is Bill. Of course, they did get carried away with their awesomeness, right? I mean, this is, 30 years later was the Peloponnesian War?
Yeah.
Like that? Where,
yeah.
So they did not take sufficient heed of that warning. And of course, when you're the victor, it is easy to be gracious to the loser. You wonder if a play written later in Greek history, when the great king of Persia wielded a lot more influence in Greece, would have been as gracious to the Persians as this play was.
Yeah. I think it was Pat that mentioned that this takes place, right? It was written only less than a decade after the after that victory. Can you imagine how easy it would have been for them to be carried away by it, right? And here is Aeschylus trying to bring in a little bit of, hey, let's take it easy here. And and then little by little, we'd see Athens starting to, flex its muscles against the other city states.
Hey, Andre, this is Tom, and I'm pretty new to the classic, and I really love that reading of it. I hadn't thought about that at all. I also wonder if that's maybe why the whole thing is from the perspective of the Persians in the first place. It's sort of, again, him saying, hey, humility, understand the other side. Don't get too wrapped up in your victories.
Yeah, great point. I mean, just imagine, he could have written it from another point of view, right? But he took that point of view from the Persians, and this could happen to anyone. This could happen to us at some point, right? And it almost did. I mean, Athens had its city burned, even though they won at Salamis 8 years earlier. They lost their city temporarily, and they had to rebuild it. So it wasn't, it wasn't all total glory. There was a lot of suffering on both sides. War is not a good thing, even when you win, right?
Yep.
Could be.
This is Nan.
Kind
of in line with those thoughts that other people mentioned, I thought Darius's speech on page 800, line 800, kind of goes
and
in
just
with all that.
And Nan, just give everyone a chance to get over to line 800 so we can look at the words as you read them. Be great if you did read them, by the way. But, go ahead.
these just so probably around a little further down than 800, where he says, the pitch of suffering awaits them there, a scourge to punish their ungodly thinking. For those who went to Greece were not ashamed to rob the shrines of gods and burn their temples. Altars have been destroyed, sacred buildings have been wrenched up and toppled from their bases. And so the doers of wrong shall suffer wrongs no less than they inflict. More are to come. And it just keeps going on and on. And it says, let no one allow his thoughts to pass his present fortune, or lusting for others' wealth, let slip his own. For Zeus, the grim chastiser, will be at hand with recompense for overboastful minds. And I also, a few lines above that, I liked the line, for pride will flower and bear the fruit of folly.
From which one?
A much bemoaned harvest.
That's 821, 822, yeah.
It's language, really, is beautiful language, right, Nan?
Mm-hmm.
The poetry of this translation, I know we have the translator on the line, and I'm not just saying that because I like him. I did very much like the language here. This is a great section. Hey, Andre, we have a few more minutes before we're going to switch gears and talk to Professor Rahm. I wonder if there are if there's anyone we have not heard from yet. I'm sure there is, because we have a number of people on the call that might just want to share a thought or a favorite passage.
Yeah, sure. Please jump in.
Hi, this is Pat again. I don't know why, just my favorite passage for some reason is when Darius comes back and he says the Greeks' land is their defender, and the course is, what do you mean? How does their land defend them? And it says it kills with hunger those that are too many. Like Greece is like this really poor country fighting against a very rich country.
Yeah.
And that just sort of, it's almost struck me as funny, that line.
And do you remember where that was exactly?
That's line before 800. It's right. It's like.
Right.
The chorus is talking to Darius.
Oh yeah, there it is. It's 792, right? Their land, their very lands, their ally and defender. How does their land defend them? It kills with hunger those who are too many. So, right. So that's what Herodotus. That's one of the things he says, right, that slowed down the army. They couldn't even feed everybody. They drank and ate everything up. and so Darius has this real, almost, buzzkill kind of thing going on. And he's really, like, bringing reality to these folks. But what about I wanted to make sure we talked about Atossa. She's the mother of Xerxes, the wife of Darius, I think. And what is her role here? Because she is the only character in each of the three, and I count them as three acts. One act, of course, at the beginning, and then and then the second act, I think, is when the chorus is speaking on page, let's see, she goes out and she comes back with a different costume and so forth. What is her role in all of this? I mean, she's got a very, very prominent part in this play. So anybody get that impression or notice that about this character? Yeah. She departs on line 531. That's on page 27. The chorus then renews its, its assessment of the situation, saying that, oh, yes, the army is indeed destroyed. And then Atossa comes back in with a different costume. This is on page 29 at the bottom. And of course, she...
Yeah, this is Brian.
Yes.
Hello? Yes.
Yes, go ahead, Brian.
This is, to me, she's just more or less facilitating each theme of the play, each part of the play, when they're worrying about what's going to happen. when Darius comes back and chastises Xerxes for hubris, and then when Xerxes comes in and chastises himself. So she's just kind of like, I don't know, straight man or facilitator, something like that. She introduces everything.
She is kind of the, right, the guiding force. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about how the production was, how the play was produced, because I read a long time ago, I don't have the citation, I don't know maybe the book or the author, but I read a long time ago, like when I was in college in like the 70s, that the Greek plays, each, they were given a chorus and a choreographer or whatever, and three actors, and that's all they were allowed. So, and I don't know if they have, and they had a, this, that was sort of the rules of the competition. You could only have like the three, you had a chorus and then you had three actors that had to take all the parts.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, would a Tasa have, how are the parts distributed? Would a Tasa have been played by the same actor, or would another actor, like, have been the messenger and another actor been, Tasa in the first part when she's talking to the messenger, and another actor would be a Tasa when she's in the second part when she's talking to Darius. And, you know, and like, she goes off then after Darius to go get some robes for her son, but I mean, maybe she had like a costume change or a mask change that she had, to come back as Xerxes or something, because there's four parts. You're a messenger, a Tasa, Darius and Xerxes. And so how would those have been distributed among the actors? Maybe they split Atasa's part to make it more even for the actors or something?
Yeah,
well, that's a great question, and Andre, do you mind if I jump in and say
not at all? Yeah,
okay.
I'll do this.
Great. So what I want to do now is I'd like to welcome officially Professor Rahm to our conversation. I asked him to listen and take some notes on what he heard us talking about. Obviously there were some questions that were asked. For example, why were the Persians praying to the Greek gods? We had a conversation about the word barbarian. We talked a lot about the Iliad and its connection to relationship influence on Persians, and other elements. And, of course, the last speaker, was that Pat?
Hello?
Yeah.
Was the last speaker? I'm sorry. I didn't get the name. Yeah, was asking about how this was staged and what were the role of the actors, and did they play multiple parts and did they switch parts and so on. And so, and we talked a little bit about the translation. And of course, why was it that Aeschylus took the perspective of the Persians, and how is it that they weren't simply gloating over the victory of Salamis and Plataea. So let me ask first, Professor Rahm, what's this been like for you to listen to these adults here on the call tonight struggle to talk about and understand this text? And as you answer that question and share your thoughts, I want to invite people who, especially those of you who didn't talk yet, I think Scott, well, Scott, you spoke, I think. Edward Leary, Josh Kirshner, Harry Keller, I think we didn't hear from you. Stuart, I'm not sure if we heard from you. Anyone who we did not hear from in the earlier conversation, I'd like you to ask some questions. You can email me with your thoughts, and then I can try and call on you to bring you in here. Okay, but first, let's hear from Professor Rahm. What's this been like? What would you like to address from what you've heard tonight?
Yes. Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me and for letting me listen in to this very interesting conversation. It's a delight to hear people enjoying the book and having a good experience with the book. We intended it just for audiences like this one. people reading tragedy, you know, without a lot of expertise or a lot of background, but just wanting to enjoy these magnificent plays. So I don't quite know where to start. I guess the first exchange that you guys had was, to me, one of the most interesting about why the Greeks are taking the perspective of the Persians. It's a fascinating question, and it's rather complicated because at times the Greeks seem to
be... Professor Rahm, let me just jump in. There's some sound that's happening in the background that's making it hard to hear you.
Yeah. Is it coming from me?
Aware. No, I don't think it's coming from you. I think it possible it is, but it sounds like I can't tell exactly. That's right there. I don't know if any of you are aware. Maybe what we'll do, just so we can hear Professor Rahm, is I might. Well, that will end up muting him.
Wait,
as well.
Sorry, mine wasn't muted. I'll mute it. I apologize.
Okay. All right. Great. It sounds like the sound is better. Okay. Sorry for that. You were just getting into a great juicy comment about why were the Greeks, why did Aeschylus take the perspective of the Greeks and so on. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really a double perspective because at times we're aware that the actors on stage are Greeks or Athenians, and they're addressing an audience who are Athenians, and they let the mask slip a couple of times. And there are comments that are put in the mouths of the Persians that indirectly offer praise to the Greeks. For example, when Atossa asks, you know, she's trying to find out more about the Athenians, and she asks, who is their overlord or something
yeah.
like that? And the chorus say, well, they don't really have one. And she says, what? That's not possible. How could they fight without a despot over them? That's a backhanded way of saying that the Athenian system, the incipient democracy of Athens, was really a superior system because, of course, people were fighting very bravely for that system without having to be whipped or terrorized. So there's a kind of a dropping of the mask from time to time where we see that the really Greeks speaking and listening and admiring their victory, even as we're officially mourning for the defeat of the Persians. So it's a remarkable achievement to keep those two things going at the same time.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And that's very helpful. I'm sure everyone on the phone is thinking, oh, thank you. that deepens our appreciation. What do you think about the influence of the Iliad on this play?
Well, that was a great discussion, too. The someone mentioned the catalog of shifts, and, of course, that is very much the feeling of these long lists of names of casualties, the great leaders who've fallen in battle, very somnolent and incantatory, and Aeschylus is working with the same heroic mode of the Iliad, the tragic heroic mode of the Iliad. It's also closely paralleled by Herodotus's histories. I don't know if your group is going to read any Herodotus, but...
many of us have read Herodotus that are on the call tonight, James. Some of them have been with us now for years. And some of the people who are new to us may have read Herodotus independently, but I'd say about approximately half of us have read Herodotus. Yeah.
All right, great. So this battle... The Battle of Salamis is also the climax of Herodotus' histories and is also presented there as the tragedy of Persia's downfall, even though it's clearly a victory for Greek values and Greek military skill. It's not clear when the histories was written. Certainly it was after the play of the Persians, but there's enough overlap between the two that it seems that Herodotus knew the play.
Yeah.
And he was working with some of the same themes as the play.
Yeah.
But of Aeschylus, you'll see this even more when you get to the Oresteia next time. All of Aeschylus is deeply immersed in Homer's Iliad. He said himself that he was carving slices from the great banquet of Homer.
That's cool.
That is very cool. All right, so let's hear from those of you on the call. Again, I'd love to start by hearing from anyone who has not yet spoken. Josh, do you have a question for Professor Rahm? Or comment?
No. A comment, yes. Thank you for joining us. This is greatly helpful to have you join us on these calls. This is my...
Well, it's a pleasure.
Having been through a number of these, including Herodotus, it's great to have your insights. I don't have a specific question. I've just been enjoying the conversation, so I don't want to take up more time for others that maybe do have more insightful questions to ask.
Okay. Well, let me just share, Josh. I just want to share with everyone's. Hopefully everyone saw your introduction over email today. Andre and I were talking about it earlier. In fact, you reminded us how much we've done. So, Professor Rahm, Josh shared with the group earlier today on email that he has, with us, read through the Iliad, the Odyssey, Herodotus, Thucydides, Xenophon, both Hellenica and Anabasis, the Aeneid, Livy's Hannibal, Arrian's Alexander, Ovid, Aristophanes, Lucretius, and probably one or two he's forgetting.
Wow. That's quite a curriculum. Congratulations.
He joined.
You should award certificates.
Yes, we should, actually. We should. We should partner with Bard College to give some kind of a continuing adult education classicist credit or something.
Well,
anyway.
Right there, you read more than most of my students have, so congratulations.
Hey, this is Phil. Speaking of Xenophon, has anyone really talked about, in the past, that part of the tragedy of Xerxes is is less than 100 years later, the great king of Persia was sort of dominating Greece without, if Xerxes had been more patient, could he have achieved dominance in Greece without, that's part of his tragedy, that it may not have been that hard for him to have conquered Greece if he had used diplomatic rather than, less aggressive means to do so.
That's true, yes. His descendants ended up in the driver's seat for Greek politics without really having to lift a finger.
It's part of, big part of the tragedy. And the lesson here is brute use of force may not be the best way to win these kinds of situations.
Go ahead, John.
Is it okay if I ask a question, even though I spoke before?
Elizabeth.
Thank you. My question is the ghost of Darius, when he comes back, he seems to sort of not know what's going on and be saying, why did you summon me? What's happened? And he seems very confused. But then, which I thought was interesting, because you could have it that people who were, shades would kind of be observers. But, for him, he's been underground, he doesn't know. But then when he goes on and talks, it seems as though actually he does know a lot about what's happened. So I wonder if there is any theory about, people who were dead.
Yes.
This is Sean. I have the same reaction. It felt to me like it was just sloppiness.
Well, I mean, he does have a kind of general moral knowledge, but not a knowledge of current events, if you will. So I guess the idea of ghosts is that they have a kind of cosmic wisdom, or you know, a wisdom about general principles. And he knows about oracles, which we don't hear of anywhere else, that there were oracles which predicted the downfall of the Persian army. And he's surprised it came so soon. He was expecting it to come later. Mm-hmm. So, but it is a great problem that, you know, as you readers of Herodotus know, Darius led his own invasion of Greece and failed also. And he doesn't acknowledge having done that.
No.
And he speaks like someone who would never dare to do that.
Right.
So how much do we trust him? He's not the morally blameless commentator that he seems to be. He seems to want to be. Is Aeschylus subtly undercutting him with dramatic irony? We know that he's not what he seems to be, or has he sort of been purged of his moral sin in the underworld, and he's now remade as a sage? It's hard to say. The Darius theme is actually quite problematic the more you look at it, because he presents an interpretation of why Xerxes failed. He wants us to understand the reasons for Xerxes' failure, but can we entirely trust him? It's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Rahm, this is Andre.
Yes.
May I ask,
hi,
please, while we have you, can you help us in a way, what's the best way for us to visualize these plays in our minds as terms of actors and staging, like to help us sort of bring in the dynamics, you know, of the drama to the actual literature itself? Like, so there was a question earlier about how Aeschylus had brought, you know, there was something about Aeschylus's plays involved two or three actors at a time, and then Sophocles might have more. I don't know. Is there anything to any of that, or is there something we should be thinking about when we're reading about these characters and how they're interacting or something in a visual sense?
Yeah. If I could interject, Andre, because I was going to address Professor Rahm's point a little earlier. This is Frank.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to like, page 33, starting about line 715, so like Darius did wake up from the dead, and now he has like a kick the cat with a torso. Like, what really went on? And she, there's about 20 questions where he asks her what happened, and she kind of responds. So I don't know if that sheds a little light on, you know, how he's entering the how his ghost is entering the action right now.
Mm.
It's just like 20
yeah.
back and forth one-liners.
Yes, right. What's called stichomathia. Yes, so she has to fill him in on everything that's happened, you know, from the factual point of view. But then he claims to understand it all from the cosmic point of view and to know why it happened. So anyway, to get to the question about staging and visualization, you know, the hardest thing is the chorus. And we have to remember that the chorus was a group of dancers and that they were dancing these odes as well as singing them. So, and of course they divided the strophe and antistrophe, two halves of the chorus that were dancing responsively to one another. We don't know quite what that would have looked like, but it was surely a huge part of the effect of the drama, which is entirely lost to us. There were two actors at this time. You notice that there's only two speaking parts on stage at any one time. Later you'll get to the Orestia, in which there's three.
and there were never more than three. So the Greek just never saw any need to have more actors on stage at one time. This play is extraordinarily static. There's very little action, and the primary movement is the processional march that occupies the whole last few hundred lines. After Xerxes comes on stage, he and the chorus sing responsibly to one another, and he seems to be sort of slowly processing across the stage in a kind of funeral march. Just all music and movement, but again, you know, very hard to reconstruct.
Right.
But someone raised the point, you know, that this feels like a sympathetic treatment of the Persians ultimately, and I think unmistakably in that last sequence, we have to be mourning for Xerxes' downfall. There's just no other way. You know, that can't be an ironic scene. It's deeply felt and quite remarkable for that reason.
How radical. I mean, can you help us get into the mindset of the Athenians of the moment that this play was being produced? Like, do we have any sense of how fresh and radical a concept this was to, first of all, to do a tragedy, secondly, to take the perspective of the enemy and to have some empathy for that enemy? Do we have a sense of how novel and revolutionary in a way this might have been?
Well, you have the same dynamic in the Iliad, right? Trojans are a foreign race, non-Greek people, and yet they're
right.
deeply admired.
And
Herodotus deals with the Persians the same way. I guess you could say, you know, unlike in the modern superhero movie or the, good versus evil spectaculars that we see in the cinema, the Greeks liked a story better if there was a noble opponent. It's no fun to defeat pure evil or monsters. It's much more interesting if two noble races are competing with one another. You notice the dream of Atossa, which hasn't come up yet. In the dream of Atossa, where she's dreamed that her son was trying to tame two women who were pulling his chariot, and one of the women ends up throwing off the yoke and upsetting the chariot. The two women are described as sisters, and they're both tall and beautiful, even though one of them is clearly an Asian and the other is Greek.
European,
And the Asian woman takes the yoke and submits willingly, and the Greek throws it off. So they're politically distinct. One of them is much less willing to accept servitude, but they're sisters, and they're both tall and beautiful. So I think that says it all right there.
Ah, such a great...
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Jordan, if I could jump in for a question.
Sure.
Yes, please.
Is there a particular passage that you found really struggling to translate? And is there one that you're most proud of having the way it turned out?
In this play, no, I can't say there was any great highs or lows linguistically, and it's all pretty uniform. I also did The Prometheus Bound, which I gather you're not going to read, but I'm especially proud of the last scene of The Prometheus Bound, which involves an exchange between Hermes and Prometheus. So if you have a chance, and I think that's my best work in this volume.
We should read, even it. Look, these, you know, it's now extra credit.
Come on, Phil.
Yeah.
I should say, by the way, that everyone thinks of Prometheus Bound as being Aeschylus, but there's good reason to think that it's not by Aeschylus, and it's not by Sophocles or Euripides either. It's by another playwright whose name is unknown to us and may not have even been written for the stage, may have been written as a literary exercise. So if you take that perspective, it's a unique document, totally unlike any of the other plays, and just indicates how much we've lost through losing the other hundreds and hundreds of tragedies. There were probably lots of amazing work in there, and we just happen to have this one that got preserved under the name of Aeschylus.
Interesting. Professor Rahm, how many do we believe, what percentage of the plays written do we think we have? Is this just a small sample of what we think was produced?
Yes, so this is an important matter, the preservation of these particular plays. So Aeschylus wrote over 100 plays, produced over 100 plays, as did Sophocles, and we just have 7 from each. And those 7, for in each case, were chosen by schoolmasters of late antiquity as the plays that school children had to read. They were the penguin classics of the day. And because they circulated in so many copies for school use, they survived. So we do have a greatest hits selection for both of those two playwrights. For Euripides, we have over 20 plays, and 7 of them seem to have been preserved in the same way as greatest hits, selected out for their school use. And then there are 14 others that were produced, that were preserved at random from a alphabetic collection, from a scroll which contained the plays beginning with H and I. So for Euripides, we have a whole selection of plays beginning with H and I, which are random, not chosen for their quality or for their canonical features, but just because that one volume happened to survive. So we have a very different array for Euripides, much wider array. And some work which we would today consider, you know, mediocre or hack work. But it just happened to get preserved. And the volume that you have, the Greek plays volume, presents about half of the surviving canon, the ones which we thought were the most important for school use. So there's a whole other half, which we hope to do someday as volume 2,
And also, Professor, isn't there a lot of, like, references to other Greek plays in Roman literature that kind of gives you a better idea of the spectrum that was available once upon a time?
Yes, there's quotations from plays which are now lost all through late antiquity. People are spouting lines of the Bellerophon, or plays which we wish we had, which were very well known at the time, but which didn't make it into those collections. There's also, of course, the Roman tragedies of Seneca, the 8 surviving tragedies by Seneca, which I think of as very, very good, but a very different style than the Greek tragedy.
Yeah. Well, let me ask Jordan Schneider, are you on the line with us? I don't know if you're still with us. We haven't heard from you this evening.
I asked the passage question.
Oh, you did?
Oh,
great.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Oh, I'm glad you're here, Jordan. This is your first call with us. Am I correct about that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You did you study the classics?
Yeah, I did Greek and Roman, mostly history, back in college.
Great. Did you tackle Herodotus?
I have a marked up landmark edition sitting in my on my wall right now.
That's great. Well, Robert Strassler is a good friend. He's on our board, as is Professor Rahm, actually, and Paul Cartledge at Cambridge. Well, welcome. I'm glad you're here with us, Jordan.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
I don't know
let me
if,
say a quick word about – oh, sorry.
Yes. Go ahead.
I want to say a quick word about translation because someone asked about, you know, what was particularly hard.
Yes.
This play has – a great number of laments, you know, words like feu and autototoi and ai.
Yeah.
And these very musical Greek words of lament, which English has no equivalent for whatsoever. And so the question for translators is, do you try to get them into English, or do you put them into a stage direction, or do you have a scream or some other sound? So I elected just to transliterate them, and you guys can all decide how well that works. If you compare it with the Agamemnon that you're going to read next, Sarah Rudin did not transliterate any of those Greek sounds. She chose to do it in other ways, and she finds the transliteration off-putting. So it's a judgment call. It's a matter of taste, but they're a huge part of the tragic lexicon, these words of lament, and a huge problem for the translator.
I would like to hear, I have an opinion on that, but what did you guys think about the transliteration of those expressions of lament in the Persians here? You all know what we're talking about, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think you could have come up with anything like, you know, alas or oh no. Or, you know, I don't think it wouldn't work.
Yes.
Well, maybe with Yiddish and Italian, we might have some near misses.
Yes. Alas is unfortunately our only near equivalent, and it gets very tired very fast.
Very vague.
Oh, I was thinking Yiddish. Oy. I mean, some of these are very close to oy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, the word oy is often in there. But,
yeah.
You know, this play in particular is very rich in these sounds, oa, a-s, and just at the end, just a repeated a. So, I tried to recapture some of that musicality. Just as with the names, the Persian and Egyptian names are also done very musically. Aeschylus is clearly just enjoying the sounds, the rolling sounds of the barbarian.
Professor Rahm,
well, that would be close. I mean, because this was all set to music, right? The whole play.
Well,
and
not
so
really.
That would be part of.
Yeah.
Yes. So
go ahead.
The music would have come in the choral odes, and in passages like the exchange between Xerxes and the chorus, what's called the komos, where a character is trading musical lines with the chorus. But the speeches and dialogue are not set, and we distinguish those by moving them out a little further to the right hand, to the left hand margin. So you can see a difference in the typesetting when the lines move in a bit or indented a bit, then they're musical. They're what's called lyric. And when they move out again, then it's spoken.
Okay. So I know we've really lost like all the music and the stage directions and everything. I mean, could you give us like sort of an idea of how it was staged? Like when the ghost of Darius comes back, I mean, would that have, how would they have done that? I mean, you know,
yeah,
in modern days, you have smoke and mirrors and.
Yeah, there seems to have been some way to get actors up from the ground, from underneath the stage, the trapdoor mechanism maybe, because we have several ghosts who make their entrances, or in this case, Darius redescends to the underworld. So there probably is some kind of trapdoor.
Like, would this have been sort of an, I know that you probably don't have an answer because nobody's gone back in time to see a Greek play, but like, would it have been sort of like an opera or like kabuki, something like that, when you watched it?
Well, if you mean, was it very sort of static and non-natural? You know, is it a sort of artificial genre with people standing and declaiming? It is very hard to say. I don't picture it that way. I picture it with natural movements. And, you know, the masks that the actors were wearing were not stylized. They were natural, painted to look like actual portraits of people. I think that it, and Aristotle says that the iambic trimeter, the meter of spoken dialogue, is used because it sounds the most like actual speech. And in fact, when people speak, have meaning to, they often fall into iambic trimeter. So I think it was probably more naturalistic than kabuki or opera.
Oh, okay. More than
opera.
Okay.
Well, opera has the convention that people are always singing. You know, there's no spoken dialogue in opera. So, in that sense, it's very it's very conventional. But here, the spoken lines were actually spoken. So I picture it being, you know, more modern or naturalistic than it's often done today. When people try to do it, a lot of directors go for something very stylized or even primitive, and I don't think that's right. Put on recently in New York, Persians was put on in 2003 in New York City. I don't know if anyone
Scott
saw it, but
on the fall saw that production actually.
By the Tony Randall Theater Company. I thought it was quite good, and it was fairly naturalistic, you know, stately and elevated, but, you know, this is a mother worried about her son. This is a father who's scolding his son. It's there are relationships that we can all understand that are familiar.
We have a couple of people I think who want to ask questions. I heard at least two voices.
This is Kitty. Professor Rama, I had read that some scholars think that in the metered language of the plays, the different syllables in each beat were set at a different pitch, so that it had a musical quality even when it wasn't sung. Do you have an opinion about that?
No, I don't. I don't know if we have any evidence about that. Aristotle says that it's the most like everyday speech. And we often fall into that same meter just without even trying. So I think it sounded fairly natural, like natural speech.
Professor, this is Harry Keller. I've got one question, and that is,
did they have any musical instrument accompaniment to this?
Yes.
The chorus begins to launch into this. Did they have flutes? Did they have? Because I was trying to imagine this, and music is such an integral part of the human experience. I imagine they gave that a significant amount of detail and thought.
Yes. The music would have been a huge part of the drama. We know that. There was musical instruments accompanying the chorus. And there is even a small snatch of music that's preserved from a play by Euripides. And there are people who try to reconstruct what it must have sounded like. For Aeschylus, I don't think we have any evidence at all. The opening chorus is an anapestic meter, a sort of marching meter, and that's usually when the chorus is in a kind of agitated state. You know, they're worried, they're anxious. So the anapest would have been would have acted out that kind of feeling.
Right.
But what the music sounded like, we don't know.
Someday, maybe we'll have a time machine.
There you go.
Or we may find more manuscript evidence. You know, there's things that turn up all the time, and papyrus evidence even.
They have a system for writing music like we have? I mean, it would be a different system, but...
They have musical notation,
yeah.
I guess. And,
yes, absolutely, yeah. But none of it survived. The surviving scrap of Euripides' Orestes, I think, is preserved from a papyrus. And it's musical notes on some kind of a scale, but it's not the modern scale. So scholars have had to try to decode, you know, what it represents in modern terms. And you can find it online. It's played, you know, by an orchestra and tried to reconstruct with.
That's so cool.
Anyway, these are all technical questions. I wonder if there are any more sort of thematic questions or about the meaning of the play.
Yeah.
There was a question go ahead.
I'm sorry, I had a question.
Yeah.
Oh, this is Brian.
Yes.
I don't know. When I read it, it kind of seems to me like this play is a variation on the theme of Icarus, almost. I don't know if you got that from it or anybody else did, but that's what I thought. He flew too close to the sun. His father warned him, and he ended up getting harmed anyways because he didn't listen to him.
Yes. Well, that's very much what Darius says, that he tried to shackle the god. He talks about the bridging of the strait of Hellespont as like shackling the god. So he overstepped the bounds of what mortals should attempt, and then he was punished. So that's a standard tragic reading. Hubris leads to downfall. Again, it's complicated because he did something similar himself.
Right.
And does he really know what he's talking about? Is it that clear cut? So I don't know. I think the play is more slippery than it at first appears, and hard to reduce it to a single moral lesson. You could say that Darius is just one voice, and there are other possible voices, the chorus, for example, who usually don't blame Xerxes, strangely enough, for the destruction of the army. They do once or twice, but mostly they don't, and they just lament along with him. And there's his mother, who had the dream and you know, in the dream, Xerxes is more or less blameless. He's the victim. It's rather more complex than just the Icarus story.
Yeah.
And
I mean, this is Sean. In his defense, the bridging worked out pretty well, right? I mean, technically speaking.
Technically speaking, yes, it did. I mean, it was a pretty amazing.
He went wrong, it seems. He thought he could just crush the whole thing in one shot, right? I'm not sure I understood the mechanics of the battle, but he seems to have put all of his army on an island so they would get all the sailors as they came to shore. Is that basically how they got slaughtered?
Well, there were a couple of disasters. Yes, he put men onto the island, thinking that the Greeks would have to wash up there,
right,
and they'd kill them. And in fact, the island was surrounded, and his men were killed. That was one mistake. The battle itself was a huge mistake. And then on the way home, he got into terrible trouble on the retreat, falling through the ice on the Strymon River and going through Thrace, getting, you know, starving and thirsty and so on. So it's a series of disasters.
But I think, my feeling was the first two of those were just strategic mistakes, whereas the latter was just kind of you're in disarray and the like.
Yes. Well, the episode of the Strymon is very interesting because the river was frozen, and it seemed as if it was safe to cross. And then as soon as the sun rose, and the messenger doesn't call it the sun, he calls it the god. As soon as the god rose, then the ice melted and the men fell through. And that's the exact inverse, of course, of the bridging of the Hellespont. It's the making of land, what seems to be land, into water, or if the bridge made water into land. So you could read it as a, you know, tit for tat retribution.
Yeah, that's cool.
And for the bridging of the Hellespont. But it's a collective punishment, right? Because the men who fell in weren't responsible. And in fact, it was the ones who were, you know, they prayed to the god before they crossed. They're at their most pious at the moment when the sun rises and they break through. So there's something very distressing about all that morally. They're being held to blame for Xerxes' guilt or Xerxes' fault or something. That's why I say the play is really quite slippery when you start to look at any of the moral judgments close up. None of them really hold up. And I don't know if that's Aeschylus deliberately being cagey and forcing us to struggle, or if there are things which would have gone by quickly in a production and the audience wouldn't have made nearly so much of them.
So one of the things that you say, Professor Omnisistil, in the introduction that I found so helpful as I thought about this play, and I'll read a quote here, is that you say the illusions that they created, and you're referring to the play, help to remind the audience of the insufficiency of human knowledge and of the contrast between human understanding and that of the immortal gods. And you go on to say that it's not necessarily the case that that the lead characters, in this case Xerxes, makes a big mistake or, you know, is flawed in some fatal way, but they forget that they, like everyone else, is subject to error. no matter their intentions or, you know, whether they deserve to have made a mistake or not, and to, and the retribution or the reaction that comes from it. And so I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. You know, today we know that human understanding is limited and that we're plagued by blind spots. You know, we have the behavioral economists to thank for pointing that out. But the Greeks, it seemed to me, understood that 2,500 years ago. And that this play and your framing of this, I thought, made that point really effectively. So I'm wondering if you think I'm, you know, understanding the point you're making and how you, if there's anything more you'd like to add.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about is the account of Persian history that Darius gives, the five generations.
The five generations, yeah.
Yeah, prior to Xerxes, who built the Persian Empire up to its height of glory. And, you know, interestingly, they're all expansionist conquerors, right? So, again, you know, what did Xerxes do that was so different? He just went one step farther, but things had to end somewhere. The empire had to stop expanding somewhere. And he may have just come along at the wrong moment. He was just in the wrong place in the sequence. You know, Darius had oracles that the Persian army would fall, and he said it didn't expect it to happen so soon. But
yeah,
it was going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah.
And that's how history is. You know, Herodotus has much the same idea, that there's a natural peak and decline in the life cycle of states.
Yeah. He says that directly in the introduction, Herodotus does, right?
Yes. So in some sense, what we're seeing is the working out of history, and it just so happens that Xerxes came along at the moment of the downturn.
Ah, so do you is that your perspective on the play? In some sense, that there isn't really some terrible overreach or mistake that he's made, or that it's due to his arrogance, or you know, this notion that you introduced to us, the ate. But it's just,
well,
that,
inevitably that's a part of it. Inevitably, yeah. Ate and hubris are a part of it, but it's not the whole story. And I guess I don't feel like I have a understanding of the play that allows me to formulate it in one or two sentences. It's really more complex than that. There are five or six different reasons given for why Xerxes failed. And then when we see Xerxes on stage, we're not reminded of any of those. We in fact see him as a sympathetic and rather humble figure.
Yeah.
With bags and brought down to, you know, to a fairly low level. So it resists easy categorization.
So interesting. Well, listen, it's 9:40. This is one of the longest calls we've had in a long time. Everyone, I can tell, is still on the line. It's 19 people still with us here. This has been such a pleasure to kick off the reading of these plays with first a conversation led by Andre and all of you, and then to have a chance to hear from you, Professor Rahm. Before we end, I just wanted to ask, would anyone like to jump in and share their perspective on what we're talking about right now and what Professor Rahm just said about how
this play escapes characterization in a sentence or two, and thinking about, you know, hubris versus bad luck or timing and history, et cetera. What do you all think about this? Anyone want to share some final words before we end?
I've stunned them into acquiescence.
Well, it's been such a wonderful call, and thank you to Professor Rahm and to everybody for being on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted that people are using this volume and enjoying it, and I'll be happy to rejoin you some other time.
You gave us more than I hope we could have.
We appreciate
love that. Yeah. This volume is a real gift. You know, your footnotes are terrific. What you do to help us understand the context. I do happen to be a big fan of the what do we call the emotional laments, the ois, the ahs. I love the way that you did them here. I look forward to reading Sarah's translation and see what we think about that. And we'll have a dialogue with her. But this I thought was it's a real gift, and I want to thank you. And I want to thank Andre. So wonderful. This is Andre's back. He spent a couple of years. He ran the Texas Classical Association. He did a number of things, which were terrific. And now he's back as our moderator. I know some of you have known him a long time, and it's a thank you, Andre.
Thank you.
Andre, maybe I'll ask you, would you like to share a final thought here or ask a final question of Professor Rahm?
I've just been soaking this all up. I thank you, Professor. Thank you. Thank you, Phil. We'll come up with more questions, though. Let's keep them coming.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll say goodnight then.
All right.
All right. Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Okay. All right. Take care.